This is Audible.
Listening Library presents A Reaper at the Gates by Saba Tahir. Read for you by Fiona Hardingham, Catherine McEwen, and Steve West. With Maxwell Caulfield. Part 1. The King of No Name.
Chapter 1. The Nightbringer. You love too much, my king. My queen spoke the words often across the centuries we spent together. At first, with a smile, but in later years, with a furrowed brow. Her gaze settled on our children as they tore about the palace, their bodies flickering from flame to flesh, tiny cyclones of impossible beauty. I fear for you, Meheria, her voice trembled. I fear what you will do if harm comes to those whom you love. No harm shall befall you, I vow it. I spoke with the passion and folly of youth, though I was not, of course, young, even then. That day, the breezes off the river ruffled her midnight hair, and sunlight poured like liquid gold through the sheer curtains of the windows. It lit our children umber as they trailed scorch marks and laughter across the stone floor. Her fears held her captive. I reached for her hands. I would destroy any who dared hurt you, I said. Meheria, no. I have wondered in the years since then if she already feared what I would become. Swear you would never. You are our Meheria. Your heart is made to love, to give, not to take. That is why you are king of the jinn. Swear it. I swore two vows that day. To protect always, to love always. Within a year, I had broken both. The star hangs from the wall of the cavern, far from human eyes. It is a four-pointed diamond with a narrow gap at its apex. Thin striations spiderweb across it. A reminder of the day the scholars shattered it after imprisoning my people. The metal gleams with impatience, potent as the glare of a jungle beast closing in on prey. Such vast power within this weapon, enough to destroy an ancient city, an ancient people, enough to imprison the jinn for 1,000 years, enough to set them free. As if sensing the armlet clinging to my wrist, the star rattles, yearning toward the missing piece. A wrench shudders through me as I offer the armlet up, and it oozes away like a silver eel to join with the star. The gap shrinks. The four points of the star flare, lighting the far reaches of the speckled granite cavern, eliciting a wave of angry hisses from the creatures around me. Then the glow fades, leaving only pallid moonlight. Ghouls swish at my ankles. Master, master. Beyond them, the Wraith Lord awaits my orders, along with the Ifrit kings and queens, of wind and sea, sand and cave, air and snow. As they watch, silent and wary, I consider the parchment in my hands. It is as unobtrusive as sand. The words within are not. At my summons, the Wraith Lord approaches. He submits reluctantly, cowed by my magic, straining always to be free of me. But I have need of him yet. The wraiths are disparate scraps of lost souls, joined by ancient sorcery and undetectable when they wish to be, even by the Empire's famed masks. As I offer him the parchment, I hear her. My queen's voice is a whisper, gentle as a candle on a chill night. Once you do this, you can never come back. All hope for you is lost, Meheria. Consider. I do as she asks. I consider. Then I remember she is dead and gone and has been for a millennium. Her presence is a delusion. Her voice is my weakness. I proffer the scroll to the Wraith Lord. See that it finds Bloodshrike Helene Aquila, I tell him. And no other. He bows, and the Ifrits sail forward. I order the Ifrits of Air away. I have a separate task for them. The rest kneel. Long ago, you gave the scholars knowledge that led to the destruction of my people and the Fey world. A jolt of memory ripples through their ranks. I offer you redemption. Go to our new allies in the south. Help them understand what they can call forth from the dark places. The green moon will rise 6 months hence. See it done well before then. And you, the ghouls press close. Glut yourselves. Do not fail me. When they have all left me, I contemplate the star and think of the treacherous Djinn girl who helped bring it into being. Perhaps to a human, the weapon would shine with promise. I feel only hatred. A face drifts to the forefront of my mind. Lyra of Serra. I recall the heat of her skin beneath my hands, her wrists crossed behind my neck. The way she closed her eyes and the golden hollow of her throat. She felt like the threshold of my old home when the rushes were fresh changed. She felt safe. You loved her, my queen says, and then you hurt her. My betrayal of the scholar girl should not linger. I deceived hundreds before her. Yet unease grips me. Something inexplicable occurred after Lyra of Serra gifted me her armlet, after she realized that the boy she called Keenan was naught but a fabrication. Like all humans, she glimpsed in my eyes the darkest moments of her life. But when I looked into her soul, something, someone, peered back. My queen, gazing at me across the centuries, I saw her horror, her sadness at what I had become. I saw her pain at what our children and our people suffered at the hands of the scholars. I think of my queen, with every betrayal, going back 1,000 years, to each human found, manipulated, and loved, until they freely gave me their piece of the star, with love in their hearts, again and again and again. But never had I seen her in the gaze of another. Never had I felt the sharp blade of her disappointment so keenly. Once more, only once more, my queen speaks. Do not do this, please. I crush her voice. I crush her memory. I think I will not hear her again.
Chapter 2 Lyra. Everything about this raid feels wrong. Darin and I both know it, even if neither of us is willing to say it. Though my brother does not speak much these days. The ghost wagons we track finally roll to a stop outside a martial village. I rise from the snow-heavy bushes where we've taken cover and nod to Darin. He grabs my hand and squeezes. Be safe. I reach for my invisibility, a power awoken within me recently, and one that I'm still settling into. My breath wreaths up in white clouds, like a snake, undulating to some unknowable song. Elsewhere in the Empire, spring has scattered its blossoms. But this close to Antium, the capital, winter still whips its chill fingers across our faces. Midnight passes, and the few lamps that burn in the village sputter in the rising wind. When I am through the perimeter of the prisoner caravan, I pitch my voice low and hoot like a snowy owl, common enough in this part of the empire. As I prowl toward the ghost wagons, my skin prickles. I whirl, my instinct rearing in warning. The nearby ridge line is empty, and the martial auxiliary soldiers on guard do not so much as twitch. Nothing appears amiss. You're just jumpy, Lyra, like always. From our camp on the outskirts of the waiting place, 20 miles from here, Darin and I have planned and carried out 6 raids on Empire prisoner caravans. My brother has not forged a single scrap of Seric steel. I have not responded to the letters from Araj, the scholar leader who escaped Koff prison with us. But together, with Afya Aranor and her men, we have helped to free more than 400 scholars and tribesmen over the past 2 months. Still, that does not guarantee success with this caravan, for this caravan is different. Beyond the perimeter, familiar black-clad figures move in on the camp from the trees. Afya and her men, responding to my signal, preparing to attack. Their presence gives me heart. The tribeswoman who helped me free Darin from Koff is the only reason we know of these ghost wagons, and the prisoner they transport. The lockpicks are blades of ice in my hand. 6 wagons sit in a half circle, with 2 supply carts sheltered between them. Most of the soldiers busy themselves with the horses and campfires, snow gusts down in flurries, stinging my face as I get to the first wagon and begin working the lock. The pins within are enigmas to my freezing, clumsy hands. Faster, Lyra! The wagon is silent, as if empty, but I know better. Soon, the whimper of a child breaks the quiet. It is quickly shushed. The prisoners have learned that silence is the only way to avoid suffering.
"Where the burning hells is everybody?" a voice bellows near my ear.
I nearly drop my picks. A legionnaire strides past, and a tendril of panic unfurls down my spine. I do not dare to breathe. What if he sees me? What if my invisibility falters? It has happened before, when I am under attack or in a large crowd.
"Wake up the innkeeper," the legionnaire turns to the ox, hastening toward him. "Tell him to roll out a keg and prepare rooms." "Inn's empty, sir. Village looks abandoned."
Marshals do not abandon villages, even in the dead of winter. Not unless a plague has come through. But Afya would have heard if that were the case. Their reasons for leaving are not your concern, Lyra. Get the locks open. The ox and the legionnaire stalk off toward the inn. The moment they are out of sight, I get my picks in the lock. But the metal groans, stiff with rime. Come on! Without Elias Veturius to get through half the locks, I have to work twice as fast. I have no time to think of my friend, and yet I cannot quell my worry. His presence during the raids has kept us from being caught. He said he would be here. What in the skies could have happened to Elias? He's never let me down. Not when it comes to the raids, anyway. Did Shaver learn that he snuck Darin and me back across the waiting place from the cottage in the freelance? Is she punishing him? I know little of the soul catcher. She is shy, and I assumed she did not like me. Some days when Elias emerges from the waiting place to visit me and Darin, I feel the djinn woman watching us, and I sense no rancor, only sadness. But skies know I'm no judge of hidden malice.
If it were any other caravan, any other prisoner we were attempting to break out, I would not have risked Darin, or the tribespeople, or myself. But we owe it to Mamie Rila and the rest of the Scythe prisoners to try to free them. Elias's tribal mother sacrificed her body, freedom, and tribe so I could save Darin. I could not fail her. Elias is not here. You're alone. Move. The lock finally springs open, and I make for the next wagon. In the trees just yards away, Arthur must be cursing at the delay. The longer I take, the more likely it is that the marshals will catch us. When I crack the last lock, I croon a signal. Snick, snick, snick. Darts hurtle through the air. The marshals at the perimeter drop silently, left insensate by the rare southern poison coating the darts. A half dozen tribesmen approach the soldiers and slit their throats. I look away, though I still hear the tear of flesh, the rattle of a final breath. I know it must be done. Without Serik Steel, Arthur's people cannot face the marshals head on, lest their blades break. But there is an efficiency to the killing that freezes my blood. I wonder if I will ever get used to it. A small form appears out of the shadows, weapon glinting, the intricate tattoos that mark her as a Zoldara, the head of her tribe, are concealed by long, dark sleeves. I hiss at Arthia Aranor, so she knows where I am. Took you long enough. She glances around, black and red braids swinging. Where in the ten hells is Elias? Can he disappear now, too? Elias finally told Arthia of the waiting place, of his death in Koff prison, of his resurrection, and his agreement with Shaeva. That day, the tribeswoman cursed him roundly for a fool before finding me. Forget him now, liar, she had said. It's damn stupid to fall for a once-dead ghost stalker. I don't care how pretty he is. Elias didn't come. Arthia swears in Sardis and moves toward the wagons. She explains softly to the prisoners that they must follow her men, that they must make no noise. Shouts and the high twang of a bow echo from the village, 50 yards from where I stand. I leave Arthia behind and sprint toward the houses where, in a darkened alley outside the village inn, Arthia's fighters dance away from a half-dozen Empire soldiers, including the legionnaire in command. Tribal arrows and darts fly, deft counters to the marshal's deadly blades. I dash into the fray, slamming the hilt of my dagger into an ox's temple. I needn't have bothered. The soldiers go down quickly. Too quickly. There must be more men nearby. A hidden force, or a mask lurking, unseen. Liar, I jump at my name. Darin's golden skin is dark with mud to hide his presence. A hood covers the unruly, honey-colored hair that has finally grown in. Looking at him, no one would ever know he'd survived 6 months in Koff prison. But within his mind, my brother battles demons still. It is those demons that have kept him from making Serik Steel. He's here now, I tell myself sternly, fighting, helping. The weapons will come when he's ready. Mamie isn't here, he says, turning when I tap his shoulder, voice haggard with disuse. I found her foster son, Sean. He said the soldiers took her from her wagon when the caravan stopped for the night. She must be in the village. I say, get the prisoners out of here. I'll find her. The village shouldn't be empty, Darin says. This doesn't feel right. You go. I'll look for Mamie. One of you bleeding needs to find her, Arthia appears behind us, because I'm not going to do it, and we have to get the prisoners hidden. If something goes wrong, I say, I can use my invisibility to slip away. I'll meet you back at the camp as soon as I can. My brother raises his eyebrows, considering my words in his quiet way. When he chooses to be, he is as immovable as the mountains, just like our mother was.
I go where you go, sis. Elias would agree. He knows.
If you are so chummy with Elias, I hiss, then tell him that the next time he commits to helping with a raid, he needs to follow through.
Darren's mouth curves in a brief, crooked smile. Mother's smile.
Liar, I know you're angry at him, but he...
Skies, save me from the men in my life and all the things they think they know. Get out of here. Afia needs you. The prisoners need you. Go!
Before he protests, I dart into the village. It is no more than 100 cottages with thatched roofs that sag beneath the snow and narrow, dim streets. The wind wails through neatly tended gardens, and I nearly trip over a broom abandoned in a lane. The villagers left this place recently, I sense, and with haste. I tread carefully, wary of what might lurk in the shadows. The stories whispered in taverns and around tribal campfires haunt me. Wraiths tearing out the throats of mariner sailors, scholar families found in burned-out encampments in the freelands, whites, tiny-winged menaces, destroying wagons and tormenting livestock. All of it, I'm certain, is the foul handiwork of the creature that called itself Keenan, the Nightbringer. I pause to peek through the front window of a darkened cottage. In the Stygian night, I can see nothing. As I move to the next house, my guilt circles in the ocean of my mind, scenting my weakness.
You gave the Nightbringer the armlet, it hisses. You fell prey to his manipulation. He is a step closer to destroying the scholars. When he finds the rest of the star, he'll set the djinn free. Then what, liar?
But it could take the Nightbringer years to find the next piece of the star, I reason to myself. And there might be more than one piece left. There might be dozens. A flicker of light ahead. I tear my thoughts from the Nightbringer and move toward a cottage along the north edge of the village. Its door stands ajar. A lamp burns within. The door is propped wide enough that I can slip through without disturbing it. Anyone planning an ambush would see nothing. Once inside, it takes a moment for my vision to adjust. When it does, I stifle a cry. Mamie Rila sits tied to a chair, a gaunt shadow of her former self. Her dark skin hangs loosely on her frame, and her thick, curly hair has been shaved off. I almost go to her, but some old instinct stops me, crying out from deep within my mind. A boot thumps behind me. Startled, I whirl, and a floorboard creaks beneath my feet. I catch a telltale flash of liquid silver. Mask, just as a hand locks around my mouth, and my arms are wrenched behind my back.
Chapter 3. Elias. No matter how often I sneak out of the waiting place, it never gets easier. As I approach the western tree line, a flash of white nearby causes my stomach to plunge. A spirit. I bite back a curse and hold still. If it spies me lurking so far from where I'm supposed to be, the entire bleeding forest of dusk will know what I'm up to. Ghosts, it turns out, love to gossip. The delay chafes. I'm already late. Lyra was expecting me more than an hour ago, and this isn't a raid she'll skip just because I'm not around. Almost there. I lope through a fresh layer of snow to the border of the waiting place, which glimmers ahead. To a layperson, it's invisible. But to me and Shaver, the glowing wall is as obvious as if it were made of stone. Though I can pass through it easily, it keeps the spirits in and curious humans out. Shaver has spent months lecturing me about the importance of that wall. she will be vexed with me. This isn't the first time I've disappeared on her when I'm supposed to be training as soul catcher. Though she is a djinn, Shaver has little skill in dealing with dissembling students. I, on the other hand, spent 14 years concocting ways to skip out on Blackcliff centurions. Getting caught at Blackcliff meant a whipping from my mother, the commandant. Shaver usually just glowers at me.
Perhaps I, too, should institute whippings.
Shaver's voice cuts through the air like a sim, and I nearly jump out of my skin.
Would you then appear when you are supposed to, Elias, instead of shirking your responsibilities to play hero? Shaver, I was just... are you steaming?
Vapor rises in thick plumes from the djinn woman.
Someone, she glares at me, forgot to hang up the washing. I was out of shirts.
And since she is a djinn, her unnaturally high body heat will dry her washed laundry. After an hour or two of unpleasant dampness, I'm sure. No wonder she looks like she wants to kick me in the face. Shaver tugs at my arm, her ever-present djinn warmth driving away the cold that has seeped into my bones. Moments later, we are miles from the border. My head spins from the magic she uses to move us so swiftly through the forest. At the sight of the glowing red djinn grove, I groan. I hate this place. The djinn might be locked in the trees, but they still have power within this small space, and they use it to get into my head whenever I enter. Shaver rolls her eyes, as if dealing with a particularly irritating younger sibling. The soul catcher flicks her hand, and when I pull my arm away, I find I cannot walk more than a few feet. She's put up some sort of ward. She must finally be losing her patience with me, if she's resorting to imprisonment. I try to keep my temper, and fail.
That's a nasty trick. And one you could disarm easily, if you stayed still long enough for me to teach you how.
She nods to the djinn grove, where spirits whine through the trees.
The ghost of a child needs soothing, Elias. Go. Let me see what you have learned these past weeks.
I shouldn't be here.
I give the ward a violent, if ineffectual, shove.
Lyra and Darin and Mamie need me.
Shaver leans into the hollow of a tree and glances up at the snippets of star and sky visible through the bare branches.
An hour until midnight. The raid must be underway. Lyra will be in danger. Darin and Afya too. Enter the grove and help this ghost move on. If you do, I will drop the ward and you can leave. Or your friends can keep waiting.
You're grumpier than usual, I say. Did you skip breakfast?
Stop stalling.
I mutter a curse and mentally arm myself against the djinn, imagining a barrier around my mind that they cannot penetrate with their evil whispers. With each step into the grove, I sense them watching, listening. A moment later, laughter echoes in my head. It is layered, voice upon voice, mockery upon mockery. The djinn.
You cannot help the ghosts, full mortal. And you cannot help Lyra of Sarah. She shall die a slow, painful death.
The djinn's malice spears through my carefully constructed defenses. The creatures plumb my darkest thoughts, parading images of a dead, broken Lyra before me, until I cannot tell where the djinn grove ends and their twisted visions begin. I close my eyes. Not real. I open them to find Helene slain at the base of the nearest tree. Darin lies beside her. Beyond him, Mamie Reela. Shan, my foster brother. I am reminded of the battlefield of death from the first trial so long ago.
and yet this is worse because I thought I left violence and suffering behind me. I recall Shaver's lessons.
In the grove, the djinn have the power to control your mind, to exploit your weaknesses.
I try to shake the djinn away, but they hold fast, their whispers sneaking into me. At my side, Shaver stiffens.
Hail, traitor!
They slip into formal speech when they speak to the soul catcher.
Thy doom is upon thee. The air reeks of it.
Shaver's jaw tightens, and immediately I wish for a weapon to shut them up. She has enough on her mind without them taunting her. But the soul catcher simply lifts a hand to the nearest djinn tree. Though I cannot see her deploy the magic of the waiting place, she must have, because the djinn fall silent.
You need to try harder.
She turns on me.
The djinn want you to dwell on petty concerns.
The fates of Lyra and Darin and Mamie aren't petty.
Their lives are nothing against the sweep of time, Shaver says. I will not be here forever, Elias. You must learn to pass the ghosts through more swiftly. There are too many.
At my mulish expression, she sighs.
Tell me, what do you do when a ghost refuses to leave the waiting place until their loved ones die?
Well... Shaver groans, the look on her face reminding me of Helene's expression when I didn't show up to class on time.
What about when you have hundreds of ghosts screaming to be heard all at once?
Shaver says.
What do you do with a spirit who did horrific things in life, but who feels no remorse? Do you know why there are so few ghosts from the tribes? Do you know what will happen if you do not move the ghosts fast enough?
Now that you mention it, I say, my curiosity piqued. What will happen if...
If you do not pass the ghosts through, it will mean your failure as soul catcher, and the end of the human world as you understand it. Hope to the skies that you never see that day.
She sits down heavily, sinking her head into her hands, and after a moment I drop beside her, my chest lurching unpleasantly at her distress. This is not like when the centurions were angry with me. I didn't bleed and care what they thought. But I want to do well for Shaver. We have spent months together, she and I, carrying out the duties of soulcatcher mostly, but also debating martial military history, bickering good-naturedly about chores, and sharing notes on hunting and combat. I think of her as a wiser, much older sister. I don't want to disappoint her.
Let go of the human world, Elias. Until you do, you cannot draw upon the magic of the waiting place.
I windwalk all the time. Shaver has taught me the trick of speeding through the trees in the blink of an eye, though she is faster than I.
Windwalking is physical magic, simple to master.
Shaver sighs.
When you took your vow, the magic of the waiting place entered your blood. Ma'atha entered your blood.
Ma'atha. I suppress a shudder. The name is still strange on my lips. I did not know that the magic even had a name when it first spoke to me through Shaver, months ago, demanding my vow, soulcatcher.
Ma'atha is the source of all the world's fey power, Elias. The djinn, the ifrits, the ghouls, even your friend Helene's healing. He is the source of your power as soul catcher.
He, as if the magic is alive.
He will aid you in passing on the ghosts, if you let him. Ma'atha's true power is here.
The soul catcher gently taps my heart, then my temple.
And here, But until you forge a soul-deep bond with the magic, you cannot be a true soul-catcher.
Easy for you to say. You're Jin. The magic is part of you. It doesn't come easily to me. Instead, it yanks at me if I stray too far from the trees, like I'm a wayward hound. And if I touch Lyra, bleeding hells. The pain is excruciating enough that thinking of it makes me grimace.
See, traitor, how foolish it was to trust this mortal bit of flesh with the souls of the dead.
At the intrusion of her djinnkin, Shaver slams a shockwave of magic into their grove that is so powerful even I feel it.
Hundreds of ghosts wait to pass, and more come every day.
Sweat rolls down Shaver's temple, as if she's fighting a battle I cannot see.
I am much disturbed.
She speaks softly and glances into the trees behind her.
I fear the Nightbringer works against us, stealthily and with malice, but I cannot fathom his plan, and it worries me.
Of course he works against us. He wants to set the trapped djinn free.
No, I sense a dark intent, Shaver says. If harm should befall me before your training is complete...
She takes a deep breath and collects herself. I can do this, Shaver, I say to her. I swear it to you. But I told Lyra I'd help her tonight. Mamie might be dead. Lyra might be dead. I don't know because I'm not there. Skies, how to explain it to her? She's been away from humanity for so long that she can't possibly understand. Does she comprehend love? On the days when she teases me about talking in my sleep, or tells strange, funny tales because she knows I ache for Lyra, it seems as if she does. But now... Mamie Rila gave up her life for mine, and by some miracle she still lives, I say. Don't make me welcome her here. Don't make me welcome Lyra.
Loving them will only hurt you, Shaver says. In the end, they will fade. You will endure. Every time you bid farewell to yet another part of your old life, a piece of you will die.
You think I don't know that? Every moment stolen with Lyra is the infuriating evidence of that fact. The few kisses we've had, cut short because of Ma'atha's oppressive disapproval. The chasm opening between us as the truth of my vow sinks in. Every time I see her, she seems further away, as if I peer at her through a spyglass.
Fool boy.
Shaver's voice is soft with empathy. Her black eyes lose focus, and I feel the ward drop.
I will find the ghost and pass him on. Go, and do not be careless with your life. Full-grown djinn are nearly impossible to kill, except by other djinn. When you join with Ma'atha, you too will become resilient to attack, and time will cease to affect you. But until then, be wary. If you die again, I cannot bring you back. And...
She kicks at the ground self-consciously.
I've grown used to you. I won't die.
I grip her shoulder. And I promise I'll do the dishes for the next month. She snorts her disbelief. But by then I am moving, windwalking through the trees so rapidly I can feel the branches cutting my face. A half hour later, I hurtle past Shaver's and my cottage, through the borders of the waiting place, and into the Empire. The moment I'm clear of the trees, storm winds buffet me, and my windwalking slows, the magic weakening as I leave the forest behind. I feel a pull at my core tugging me back, Ma'atha demanding my return. The pull is almost painful, but I grit my teeth and continue on.
Pain is a choice. succumb to it and fail, or defy it and triumph.
Caris Veturius training, drilled into my very bones.
By the time I arrive outside the village where I was to meet Lyra, midnight is long past, and moonlight pushes meekly through the snow clouds. Please let the raid have gone smoothly. Please let Mamie be all right. But the instant I enter the village, I know something is off. The caravan is empty, the wagon doors creaking in the storm. A thin layer of snow has already settled on the bodies of the soldiers guarding the caravans. Among them, I find no mask, no tribal casualties. The village is silent when it should be in an uproar. Trap. I know it instantly, as sure as I'd know my own mother's face. Is this Caris's work? Did she learn about Lyra's raids? I pull my hood up, draw on a scarf, and drop into a crouch, observing the tracks in the snow. They are faint, brushed away, but I catch sight of a familiar boot print. Lyra's. These tracks aren't here out of carelessness. I was meant to know that Lyra went into the village, and that she didn't come out. Which means the trap wasn't set for her. It was set for me.
Chapter 4. The Bloodshrike.
Curse you!
I keep an iron grip around Lyra of Serra, but she resists me with all her strength. She refuses to drop her invisibility, and I feel as if I'm grappling with an angry, camouflaged fish. I curse myself for not knocking her out the moment I grabbed her. She lands a nasty kick to my ankle before elbowing me in the gut. My hold on her weakens, and she's out of my hands. I lunge toward the sound of her boot scraping the floor, savagely satisfied at the huff of her breath leaving her lungs as I tackle her. Finally, she flickers into being, and before she can play her little disappearing trick again, I twist her hands back and truss her tighter than a festival day goat. Still panting, I shove her into a chair. She looks at the other occupant of the cabin, Mamie Reeler, bound and barely conscious, and snarls through her gag. She kicks out like a mule, her boot connecting beneath my knee. I grimace at the pain. Don't backhand her, Shrike. Even as she fights, a fey part of my mind trills at the life within her. She has healed. She is strong. The fact should irk me. But the magic I used on Lyra binds us together, a tie that runs deeper than I'd like. I feel relief at her vigor, as if I'd learned that my little sister Livia is healthy. Which she won't be for much longer if this plan doesn't work. Fear lances through me, followed by a harsh stab of memory. The throne room. Emperor Marcus. My mother's throat. Cut. My sister Hannah's throat. Cut. My father's throat. Cut. All because of me. I will not see Livia die too. I need to carry out Marcus's orders and bring down Commandant Caris Veturia. If I don't return to Antium from this mission with something I can use against her, Marcus will take his rage out on his Empress, Livia. He has done so before. But the Commandant appears unassailable. The low-class plebeians and Makata traders support her because she quelled the Scholar Revolution. The most powerful families in the Empire, the Illustrians, fear her and Jens Veturia. She's too wily to allow an assassin close, and even if I did take her out, her allies would rise up in revolt. Which means I must first weaken her status among the Jens. I must show them that she is still human. And to do that, I need Elias Veturius, the son who is supposed to be dead, who Caris claimed was dead, but who is, I recently learned, very much alive. Presenting him as evidence of Caris's failure is the first step toward convincing her allies that she's not as strong as she appears. The more you fight me, I say to Lyra, The tighter your bonds will get. I yank on the ropes. When she winces, I feel an unpleasant twinge deep within. A side effect of healing her?
It will destroy you if you're not careful.
The Nightbringer's words about my healing magic echo in my mind. Is this what he meant? That the ties to those I healed are unbreakable? I cannot dwell on it now. Captain Avitus Harper and Captain Dex Atreus enter the cottage we've requisitioned. Harper gives me a nod, but Dex's attention flits to Mamie, his jaw tight. Dex, I say, it's time. He doesn't look away from Mamie. Unsurprising. Months ago, when we were hunting down Elias, Dex interrogated Mamie and other members of Tribe Sif on my orders. His guilt has plagued him since. Atreus, I snap. Dex's head jerks up. Get into position. He shakes himself and disappears. Harper waits patiently for orders, unruffled by Lyra's muffled curses and Mamie's moans of pain. Check the perimeter, I tell him. Make sure none of the villagers wandered back. I didn't spend weeks setting up this ambush so a curious plebe could ruin it. As Lyra of Serra follows Harper's progress out the door, I pull out a dirk and par my nails. The girl's dark clothes fit her closely, hugging those irritating curves in a way that makes me conscious of every awkwardly jutting bone in my body. I've taken her pack, along with a well-worn dagger I recognize with a jolt. It's Elias's. His grandfather Quinn gave it to him as a 16th-year fall gift. And Elias, apparently, gave it to Lyra. She hisses against the gag as her gaze darts between me and Mamie. Her defiance reminds me of Hannah. I wonder briefly if, in another life, the scholar and I could have been friends. If you promise not to scream, I tell her, I'll take off your gag. She considers before nodding once. The moment I pull off the gag, she lashes out. What have you done to her? Her seat thumps as she strains toward a now unconscious Mamie Reeler. She needs medicine. What kind of monster? The crack that echoes through the cottage when I slap her into silence surprises even me, as does the nausea that almost doubles me over. What the skies? I grab the table for support, but straighten before Lyra can see. She juts out her chin as she lifts her head. Blood drips from her nose. Surprise fills those golden cat-like eyes, followed by a healthy dose of fear. About time. Watch your tone. I keep my voice low and flat. Or the gag goes back in. What do you want from me? Just your company. Her eyes narrow, and she finally notices the manacles attached to a chair in the corner. I'm working alone, she says. Do with me what you wish. You're a gnat. I go back to paring my nails, stifling a smile when I see how the words irritate her. At best, a mosquito. Don't presume to tell me what to do. The only reason you haven't been crushed by the Empire is that I haven't allowed it. Lies, of course. She's raided 6 caravans in 2 months, freeing hundreds of prisoners in the process. Skies know how long she'd have continued if I hadn't received the note. It arrived 2 weeks ago. I didn't recognize the handwriting, and whoever, or whatever, delivered it, avoided detection by an entire bleeding garrison of masks. The raids. It is the girl. I've kept the raids quiet. We already have trouble with the tribes, who are enraged at the martial legions deployed in their desert. In the west, the Karkan barbarians have conquered the Wildman clans and now heckle our outposts near Tiberim. Meanwhile, a Karkan warlock by the name of Grimar has rallied his clans, and they lurk in the south, raiding our port cities. Marcus has only recently secured the loyalty of the illustrious gens. If they learn that a scholar rebel roams the countryside, wreaking havoc, they'll grow restive. If they learn it's the same girl Marcus was supposed to have killed in the fourth trial, they'll smell blood in the water. Another Illustrian coup is the last thing I need, especially now that Livia's fate is tied to Marcus's. Once I got the note, connecting Lyra to the raids was easy enough. The reports out of Calf Prison matched the reports about the raids. A girl who appears one moment, disappears the next. A scholar, risen from the dead, wreaking vengeance on the Empire. It was not a ghost, but a girl. A girl and one uniquely talented accomplice. We stare at each other, she and I. Lyra of Serra is all passion, feeling. Everything she thinks is written on her face. I wonder if she understands what duty even is. If I'm a gnat, she says, then why? Understanding flashes across her face. You're not here for me. But if you're using me as bait, then it will work effectively. I know my quarry well, Lyra of Serra. He'll be here in less than a quarter hour. If I'm wrong, I twirl my dirk on my fingertip. Lyra pales. He died. She seems to believe her own lie. In Koff Prison. He's not coming. Oh, he'll come. Skies, I hate her as I say it. He will come for her. He always will. As he never will for me. I banish the thought, weakness shrike, and kneel in front of her, knife in hand, running it along the K the Commandant carved into her. The scar is old now. She might see it as a flaw against that glowing skin, but it makes her look stronger, resilient, and I hate her for that, too. But not for much longer, for I cannot let Lyra of Serra walk free. Not when bringing Marcus her head could buy his favor, and thus more life for my little sister. I think briefly of the cook, and her interest in Lyra. The Commandant's former slave will be angry when she learns the girl is dead. But the old woman disappeared months ago. She might be dead herself. Lyra must see murder in my eyes, because her face goes ashen and she shies back. Nausea lashes through me again. My vision flashes white, and I lean into the wooden armrest of her chair, the knife tipping forward into the skin over her heart.
Enough, Helene.
His voice is as harsh as one of the Commandant's lashes. He's come in through the back door, as I suspected he would. Helene. Of course he'd use my name. I think of my father. You are all that holds back the darkness. I think of Livia, covering up the bruises on her throat with layer upon layer of powder so the court does not think her weak. I turn. Elias Veturius. My blood goes cold when I see that, despite the fact that I set the ambush, he has managed to surprise me. For instead of coming alone, Elias has taken Dex prisoner, binding his arms and holding a knife to his throat. Dex's masked face is frozen in a grimace of rage. Dex, you idiot. I glare at him in silent rebuke. I wonder if he even tried to fight back. Kill Dex if you wish, I say. If he was fool enough to get caught, I won't miss him. The torchlight reflects briefly in Elias's face. He looks at Mamie, at her broken body and sagging form, and his eyes sharpen in rage. My throat goes dry at the depth of his emotion as he shifts his attention back to me. I see 100 thoughts written in the set of his jaw, in his shoulders, in the way he holds his weapon. I know his language. I've spoken it since the age of 6. Stand firm, Shrike.
Dex is your ally, he says. You're short on those these days, I hear. I think you'll miss him very much. Release Lyra.
I am reminded of the third trial, of Demetrius's death by his hand. Leander's. Elias has changed. There's a darkness to him, one that wasn't there before. You and me both, old friend. I haul Lyra up from the chair and slam her against the wall, putting my knife to her throat. This time I am prepared for the wave of sick, and I grip my teeth as it washes over me. The difference between us, Veturius, I say, is that I don't care if my ally dies. Drop your weapons. You'll see manacles in the corner. Put them on, sit down, shut up. If you do, Mamie lives, and I agree not to pursue your band of caravan-raiding criminals or the prisoners they freed. Refuse, and I will hunt them down and kill them myself.
I thought you were decent, Lyra whispers. Not good, but...
She glances down at my blade, and then at Mamie.
But not this.
That's because you're a fool. Elias wavers, and I dig the knife in deeper. The door opens behind me. Harper, daggers drawn, brings a wave of cold with him. Elias ignores him, his attention fixed on me.
Let Lyra go too, he says, and you have a deal.
Elias, Lyra gasps. No, they're waiting, I hiss at her. And she falls silent. I don't have time for this. The longer I waver, the more likely Elias is to think of a way to escape. I made sure he'd know Lyra entered the village. I should have expected him to catch Dex. You idiot, Shrike. You underestimated him. Lyra tries to speak, but I dig my blade into her throat, purposefully drawing blood. She trembles, her breaths shallow. My head pounds. The pain stokes my rage, and the part of me born from the blood of my dead parents roars, claws unsheathed. I know her song, Veturius, I say. Dex and Avitas won't understand my meaning, but Elias will. I can stay here all night. All day. As long as it takes. I can make her hurt. And heal her. I do not say it. But he sees my vicious intent, and hurt her again, and heal her, until you are driven mad by it. Helene. Elias's rage fades, replaced by surprise. Disappointment. But he has no right to be disappointed in me. You won't kill us. He doesn't sound quite sure. You used to know me, I think. But you don't know me anymore. I don't know me anymore. There are worse things than death, I say. Shall we learn about them together? His temper rises. Tread carefully, Bloodshrike. The mask still lives within Elias Veturius, beneath whatever else he's become. I can push him, but I can only push him so far. I'll release Mamie. I offer the carrot before I brandish the stick. A gesture of good faith. Avitas will leave her someplace. Your tribal friends will find her. It is only when Elias looks at Harper that I remember he does not know Avitas is his half-brother. I consider whether the knowledge can be used against Elias, but decide to hold my tongue. The secret is Harper's, not mine. I nod to him. And my second carries Mamie from the cabin.
Let Lyra go too, Elias says, and I'll do as you ask.
She comes with us, I say. I know your tricks, Veturius. They won't work. You can't win this if you want her to live. Drop your weapons. Get those manacles on. I won't ask again. Elias shoves Dex away, cutting his bonds as he does so, and then levels a punch that drops him to his knees. Dex doesn't hit back. Fool.
That's for interrogating my family, Elias says. Don't think I didn't know about it.
Bring the horses round, I bark at Dex. He rises, dignified and straight-backed, as if there isn't blood drenching his armor. After he leaves the cottage, Elias drops his Sims.
You will let Lyra down, he says. You will not gag me. And you'll keep your bleeding distance, Bloodshrike. It shouldn't hurt, him calling me by my title. After all, I am not Helene Aquila anymore.